Okay. As Mike said, I'm going to talk about threats in motion, or TIM, for severe weather warnings. I am presenting this on behalf of Greg Stumpf, a colleague at the Cooperative Institute that supports the Global Systems Lab, and I'd also like to acknowledge my many colleagues on the bottom of the screen that work on this project together. So the origin of threats in motion, or TIM, we were originally testing continuously updating high resolution, what we call probabilistic hazard information, or FHIE, for severe thunderstorm, tornado, and lightning threats. And those were tested not only with National Weather Service forecasters, but also emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists in sort of a simulated integrated warning team. So threats in motion are continuously updating severe weather warnings, and they were initially derived from the probabilities. The initial hypothesis was that we could use social science to come up with this magic number at which a warning should be issued. We tried that, and long story short, it didn't work. So we essentially divorced the warnings from the probabilities and are now currently looking at the probabilities being used to help issue these threats in motion warnings, because they are intended to be for long track hazards, both, you know, severe wind and hail as well as tornado. Overall benefits of threats in motion: increase the average lead times, creating more equitable lead times, which I have a slide that illustrates that in a second. It automatically removes areas from warnings where the threat has passed, so it does create the potential for maybe something like an all-clear message. It allows the warning polygon to better respond to storm motion changes, and then just fewer warning gaps along the long track path. If you would like some really nitty-gritty information about this, check out the weather and forecasting article that was written by Stumpf and Girard in 2021. So currently warnings are issued as a series of polygons, and if you look at locations A and B in the image, you can see that if you're in location B and you're not weather aware, you're going to get a significantly shorter lead time than someone that is just to your west. So nearly adjacent locations, but inequitable lead times. So what we're hoping is that with threats in motion, the warning is automatically translated downstream, providing more equitable lead times for those nearly adjacent locations. So the way warnings are currently issued by Weather Service forecasters, official warning updates cannot be used to expand the area of the original warning. You can contract the back end of it, but when a warning expires, a new warning with a unique tracking number is issued. We're attempting to develop and implement this in stages. So sort of the closest to the current practice is what we're calling Tiny Tim. And this just allows the forecaster to extend the area, extend a warning in area, time, or both. And it keeps the same event tracking number for that warning as the threat moves. So there's no need to issue new downstream warnings if it's a long track hazard. And so this improves the average lead time and lead time equity. And then the full implementation of TIM, that is where we're using sort of like the storm motion vector that the forecaster sets to automatically translate that warning with the threat until, you know, if that initial vector, is not exactly matching what's going on with the storm, then, do I have a timer? Okay. they can adjust to get it back on track. And that is where we get sort of the biggest improvement in lead time. So I mentioned earlier we've done some evaluations in the what's called the hazardous weather test bed. If you're not familiar, it's kind of like beta testing software for forecasters. But we've expanded the scope of that and brought in emergency managers, and then we have a mock television studio for broadcast meteorologists to try out experimental products and see how they would communicate them with these hypothetical viewing audiences. So we've tested Tiny Tim with forecasters. I won't rehash all of the dates. The full implementation of TIM, the testing has gone back really to 2019. We've also done some tabletop exercises with broadcasters and emergency managers, focusing on sort of like the worst of the worst of what could happen with threats in motion and where you can get areas added in and out of a warning over a relatively short period of time and how to kind of fix that. But overall, threats in motion actually reduces forecaster workload because they're not issuing a series of warnings. It's a lot faster to modify an existing warning than to keep issuing new warnings. And it also prevents that sort of like nasty whack-a-mole of warning polygon over warning polygon over warning polygon, which I have some illustrations of. So these are some examples of how it simplifies the warning display just by allowing forecasters to modify. And so this one we're going to look at in a little bit more in depth. This is just sort of like at one point in time, there were four tornado warnings on one supercell. On the left-hand side, we have the original warnings with reflectivity and velocity. And then on the right-hand side, we have a forecaster working this event with threats in motion, with tiny TIM warnings. So it's just a lot cleaner. As I mentioned, there was some ugliness with early efforts with threats in motion. So one of them was windshield wiper effect. This has to do with changes in the motion vector or changes in the uncertainty of the motion vector. And what can happen is, if you think about a car, you can get this windshield wiper where the starred location kind of goes in and out of the warning over a relatively short period of time. So the developers have implemented what they call a 5-minute cooldown to try to prevent this from happening. So if a location has gone into a warning, it cannot be removed from that warning over the next 5 minutes. And then the other one, this one was really the most problematic for both broadcasters and emergency managers. If you think about how you play an accordion, this again has to do with that speed. That if the storm slows down, and essentially the length of the polygon is dictated by that motion vector. So if the storm speed is decreased within the threats in motion software, then it contracts the length of the polygon. So we had to implement a software fix so that that could not happen, because if a threat is approaching someone, we really don't want to take them out of the warning to then put them back in. So. What we are focusing on right now, we're developing a new hazard engine. I don't know why they call it a hazard engine, but essentially the way warnings, the messaging is generated is through something called VTEC, something time event code. I forget what the V, yes. So we are hoping to make a switch to common alerting protocol, because we really need to have common alerting protocol in order for these types of warnings to be able to be disseminated across the United States. So we are working on a hazard engine that would allow sort of a VTEC to cap translation to occur. And then I don't know what this slide is talking about. It has to do with the reason why we need the cap messaging is so that when these changes are made, people that are within that initial warning are not constantly alerted every time there's an update, but they are only alerted when it's new to them. And so hopefully I did that last slide justice. I apologize to Greg. But I will take questions. It looks like I have about 4 minutes left for questions. Is that Mike Gerber?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to explain your last slide. Your last slide was mine.
Okay. Don't you love like when your slide finds its way into somebody else's presentation? Yeah, that actually, I'm on behalf of the National Weather Service, I made a public filing to the FCC. I don't recall if it's in that filing to the FCC or if it's in the what's called the the CISRIC. It's a group where the FCC asks industry and emergency management to get together and make recommendations on improvements to wireless emergency alerts. And what actually that's illustrating there, because I think that looks like mine, is we're trying to convey that right now wireless emergency alerts does not actually do that. It doesn't. You're not able to stop the broadcast where the alert is no longer valid, you know, on the southwest side of the alert there, while at the same time just continuing the broadcast in the area where the alert remains valid. Instead, what it does is if you were to issue an update, it would cancel out the entire broadcast and restart a brand new broadcast, meaning that those people who have already received the alert will get it, the screaming tones, yet again, right? So that's a problem today. So we don't really send updates to WEA per se because we don't want the, you know, more screaming tones. But in the future, you can see, take this, now add threats in motion to it, and you can see how that problem would be exacerbated. And so that's what this, we created this to try and illustrate the issue for the Federal Communication Commission and others to see what the problem is now and what it might be in the future. So thank you. Yeah, good job on the slide. It looks really good.
Hi, Matt Ritter, National Weather Desk, and sometimes WJLA in Washington, D.C. I'm glad to see this presentation. I think this is one of the most important things coming down the pike for the entire enterprise. I was first exposed to this at a broadcast media seminar at Sterling, so I'm glad to see this update. From a broadcaster, we've all hated the overlapping polygons and whatnot. It's always difficult to visually display and convey to the audience. And part of my audience sometimes is radio. I'm talking to people in their cars. I honestly think the middle ground for this. I love the visualization of taller Tim. It's hypnotic. And I think it definitely has lots of use to highly accurate, you know, cell phone notifications. From a broadcast perspective, I think Tiny Tim is actually even easier to understand. And right. I think the vendors they're going to want that. I think they'll be able to, you know, get the coding and to be able to display that. And I just love the concept of being able to name a storm. And this is now we could have used Tiny Tim at least in Maryland, you know, 2 weeks ago with that one cell that was on the ground for 34 miles. Right. So if I had to pick one, both are improvements. I love Tiny Tim.
Thank you. I also would like to point out that, you know, we've had some dissemination-focused workshops now twice, and we have involved the Barrons and the weather companies and Midland Radio in those types of workshops. I have about 30 seconds if there's one more question.
Hey, Cody, Pierce Larkin. How do you define, like, the so when you issue a polygon in the current kind of the current setting, it's almost subjective to the forecaster. How are the edges of the polygon defined probabilistically? Is there a threshold for that when it's automatically put in? I know that we're going towards machine learning with this. How is it automatically defined in Fee to get it to the warning forecaster?
How is the warning defined?
No. The edges of the polygon. So I know it's based on probabilities.
So of a warning polygon?
Yeah. No. In Tim. With threats in motion, yes.
Okay, it's forecaster defined.
Okay. I wasn't
so
sure.
So the sort of like vision,
yeah,
is that I don't know how to define the times, but you know, because this is probably well over 10 years out, but you know, we'll say in 10 years that maybe within the hazard services software, forecasters could be using the probabilistic hazard information as a recommender for issuing the warning. And then maybe we leap forward 15 to 20 years, and maybe the private sector is able to take the probabilities with machine learning. And Nate Johnson did an amazing job of describing it as, I'm out playing tennis, my Apple Watch knows that I'm not at home and that I'm outdoors. And with machine learning and probabilistic hazard information and warnings on the way, my watch can tell me you either need to quit playing tennis and drive home now, or you have 20 more minutes to play tennis and you need to shelter where you are. So that's sort of like a long-term vision of where we might be able to go with something like this. All right. I'm out of time.
Thank you, Cody. All right, next presentation is going to be from somebody presenting virtually, and it is Tara Good, and she is presenting a high-resolution supplemental radar network deployed in the U.S. and its implications for improved weather warnings and communication.
I will just take off from there. Yeah, perfect. So really, guys, to just sorry about that technical difficulty, but to just really talk about why, first of all, myself and ClimateVision are here and doing the work that we're doing from a supplemental radar network perspective is really that every community needs weather tools and technology. And for my own personal side of the house here, I spent my first almost 10 years in public service, unfortunately responding to a variety of weather disasters on both sides of the country, rural and metropolitan populations, and certainly saw the implications of not having weather tools and technology, and then spent almost the last decade helping other developing nations build their own networks so that they could have kind of the same tools that we have here. So that's just kind of the starting point for us as a company. Next slide. Is it moving to the next one?
We got it on the next one. We just have a little bit of a lag.
Okay. All right. Well, it's okay. I know this presentation well, so we'll go with it. Sorry, guys. So the next slide, really, we're going to focus on the radar network today, but I just wanted to kind of give a lay of the land that not only are we doing the terrestrial-based network, we do use that information and all kinds of other information to improve forecasts, warnings, alerts, numerical weather prediction, et cetera. So we're involved in the entire weather enterprise, but we are going to focus on the radars today. So on the next slide, this is a map you guys have probably all seen before. This is a view of our weather network. And really, honestly, we have the gold standard of weather radar networks in this country. But there are some limitations to Doppler technology simply because we don't live on a flat Earth and a radar emits a straight beam. So what you see on the right-hand screen is really where we focus our technology on the low level of the atmosphere to try to fill voids in that lower level so that we get comprehensive coverage of the entire country. And if you flip to the next slide, that really shows you the footprint of what we've accomplished so far. So in about 2 years, we've installed 26 weather radars in these blue circles that you see on this map here. We've got our 27th coming online soon in Texas. And if you think of this map as our compass, everywhere that you see a blue circle here is where we hope to and intend to place a ClimateVision weather radar. And the orange circles represent the National Weather Radar Systems out to about 4,000 feet in the atmosphere, sort of what they describe as their best coverage. So our goal is really just to kind of fill that void in between those areas. So next slide. Shows you some of our recent installations. We do tend to install on water towers. It's just kind of a common elevated point, but we install on other things like buildings, et cetera, too. So the next couple of slides, if you flip to the next one, we'll just talk about how we do this and our approach to partnership. So next slide, slide 10. We really field these systems, we install these systems using a public-private partnership model. So I mentioned earlier, a lot of us have spent our careers in weather technology, weather sensing, public service, and we have a lot of time to really sit and understand the challenges of weather radar ownership. We've typically had the National Weather Service who owns the network, but we've also had these kind of ad hoc one-off initiatives to fill low-level gaps in observations, and they haven't been very sustainable simply because the cost and the burden of ownership became an encumbrance. So you need expertise, you need ongoing maintenance and operations. And we felt like if we can pull all these partners together and democratize that access, we do what we do best as radar experts, as radar hardware experts and scientists, bring the partners to the table, we could actually keep those radars online. So we follow a public-private partnership model. And on the next slide, you'll see that we're very entrenched in the emergency management community. They do tend to be the tip of the spear. So I heard, in the earlier session, and I know in many sessions across this conference, there's a lot of conversation about the importance of that emergency manager or that public safety community. And we concur. Additionally, we have some pretty exciting partnerships with Millersville University in Pennsylvania and Texas A&M. They're actually going to be the next recipient of one of our systems. So we also embrace the academic community because we know that that makes us better and smarter, and it certainly gives life to the next generation of experts in this field. So on the next couple of slides, I just want to talk about how we envision the data use. And we as a company, as a private partner, really believe and leaning on trusted partners. So next slide, we show you sort of, you know, how we approach getting the information out into the public sphere. We don't believe in spraying our data out just publicly, turn on a radar and send it out there. And there's a variety of reasons for that. And I think a lot of private partners have similar sort of models as well. And I would say the number one reason is really to protect the federal relationships that we have. We work very closely with the National Weather Service and NSSL, and we don't want anything that we do as a tool or a new sensor to circumvent that work, those watches, those warnings and alerts, that they're the authority. We also want to make sure the data is quality controlled, both internally and externally. And then we also want to move information through proper public safety channels, such as emergency managers, public servants, and media partners as well. And, you know, the final reason really is to pay for that sensor. We've obviously got a hefty cost involved with that. The legacy model is one-to-one. One person owns it, one person pays for it. Because we're a private owner, because we're trying to ensure that that radar can stay online, we have to expand that access and we have to spread that cost. So that's kind of our the way that we handle the data access and how it gets its way out into the public sphere. The next slide, we demonstrate really the collaborations and partnerships that we work through to make that happen. We want to make sure that every time a sensor comes online, it is benefiting the public. It is improving watches, warnings, and alerts. There's a lot of work that happens in the back end to do that, as many of you in the room know. The first and most important, as I said earlier, is really the work we do with the Weather Service and NSSL. We've been working collaboratively with them for over 2 years now through OCRADA. We also have a national MESNET program that's a limited form of access for certain weather forecasting offices. At the moment, there are about 20 offices looking at our data from about 13 radars. And as we bring radars online and continue our work with them, we hope that that will continue to expand. And we, like I said, we work very closely with them regularly to try to see how that can happen. And then you see we have a lot of trusted media partners as well who can access this information, push it through their graphic interface, et cetera, for their audiences. So they're seeing an immediate benefit the moment a radar goes online. And then we have the academic partnerships that I mentioned earlier. Finally, you know, on the next slide, in terms of the benefits and folks who can use it, we endeavor and hope that this will help a variety of other industries. And on this slide, you may have to click a couple of times to have the bullet points show up there. But we believe that energy, agriculture, insurance, transportation, these are all downstream benefits of having a new observation at the lower level. I often reference a community where we placed a radar. They had an event before we came where they had 21 inches of rain, flash flooding event that was very catastrophic, but because they were in a gap, at the time they only thought 3 inches was coming. So this is the type of implication that just having a new sensor or tool can help with and get that information to all of those folks who make the decisions related to those areas. The next couple of slides, I'm just going to walk through a few case studies. So if you'll flip to slide 17, that says North Alabama tornado. A lot of times, just really quickly on our radar, we do use an X-band radar. It's dual polarized. It sees for about 60 miles, and we've done a lot of work algorithmically to correct for attenuation, things like that, to really optimize the functionality and benefits of this radar. That said, you would sometimes think of an X-band as not being as impactful for, say, an EF3 or large convective event, but in this instance, it was. And if you flip to the next slide, I'll show you some of that data. We certainly were able to capture the event about 5 minutes before it was seen on the nearest next ride, simply because we were looking at it lower to the ground. But additionally, we were able to provide some supplemental information in very high resolution that helped corroborate what the nearest next rides were seeing. So in these slides, you can see there's a very clear, clean signature that was able to help that forecaster say, okay, I think this is happening here. Now I can be more strategic about where it's actually happening and I can corroborate what I think I already know. On the next slide, This really just shows you some events in Crossville, Tennessee, which is in a Cumberland Gap area, notable gap that has been talked about for a while. And again, this is a clear example of seeing something that was just being missed simply because it was being overshot by the nearest next red. So we were able to capture this signature. There was people down, viewers actually that helped with this. And then on the next slide, you can see that velocity signature. The couplet's pretty clear there. Fortunately, this was a pretty minor tornado, but it was great to see the clarity. Next slide is an event in Minnesota. You know, tornadoes tend to get the headlines for good reason. I'll say that, day to day, the more common application is for winter events or rain events or wind events. So the last two slides here will show you that this is an area in South Central Minnesota, West Central Minnesota. They've really struggled to understand what winter weather might be coming their way. And you see here, especially in those green areas, there were some squalls that were being completely missed on the nearest next rad. Getting this radar online, they were able to see what's actually happening on the ground so that they could plan and prepare it. The weather forecasting office in that area now also has this information. And then the next slide shows you a wind event in Texas. I've often used to looking at velocity for wind and to understand what might be happening in wind data. This was a great example of how the resolution, even in reflectivity, helped us understand certain gust fronts that were moving through an area. And there was quite a bit of damage in this part of Texas, and they were working through insurance and working with their weather forecasting office to really understand what happened here. And this actually had a downstream impact of helping them get more money from their insurance claim. So last two slides here, if we flip to the next one, I just want to give you guys a couple of lessons and takeaways and my contact information. And I'm sorry, I know we're over nine, so I hope we have time for just a couple questions. Really, I would just say the first takeaway is that filling gaps in observations has immediate benefits. We've seen it through the work that we do with our media partners. We've seen it in the work we do with the Weather Service and the NSSL. The second point is that this technology is really expensive, but when you partner together through public-private partnerships, you can really accelerate solutions and reduce the cost for everyone so that that burden is not on any one entity. And then finally, the public really trusts the media partners and federal partners. They're key contributors to community preparedness. So as a radar company invested in the technology, if we can get these tools into the right hands, it will have immediate impacts in communities, like I said earlier. And then finally, the last slide here, our partners are very enthusiastic, whether it's a media partner, broadcast partner, emergency management partner, a federal partner. These are just a sampling of the anecdotes we've gotten. You can imagine we're working in 50 states, and we're talking to excited communities all over the country. But I just wanted to give you guys a flavor for the tone and the tenor of the folks that we're working with. And then finally, last slide is my contact information. If you guys have any questions, follow-ups, I want to know more. I'm happy to answer any questions. Happy to now if we have time, but understand if not. And like I said, I have some colleagues in the room there that can help as well. So thank you, guys.
Great. Thank you so much, Tara. We have our next presentation was actually withdrawn, so we do have a couple of minutes that we can take for questions. So if we have any questions, I can run the mic over. Okay, well, it looks like we don't have any questions, so thank you so much for that presentation. To stay on schedule, maybe we'll just do a quick stretch break for everyone. If you want to stand up, as we heard yesterday, it's important to take those screen breaks and to stand up, stretch out a little bit, walk around. So maybe we'll do that, and then we'll get started with the next presentation.
Okay. another study that Jeanette did with eye tracking a few years ago. I have a question, but I'll wait till you've got that. Yeah. I guess that's
Oh, now it's on there.
Yeah, that was something I wasn't sure about.
Why? Well, it's a good thing we have a little break.
Is yours up a minute ago?
What was that? I don't think we... Did you enter your presentation?
Yeah, entered your presentation.
Oh,
yeah.
I tested it earlier. When even on the screen share, it's...
Well, we have a little break, so it's perfect timing.
Yeah. It's frozen. It's Friday morning. Of course, there's tech issues, right?
It's okay. We've been through them pretty good so far, so. It's not a message theory, so it should only be a few seconds here.
I should take this out before I forget. I'm not ejecting.
Pulled up and then I walked over there and then it's like, oh, it's not there anymore.
go ahead and get started again. So if you want to find your seats. Thank you for being patient with all the technical issues. So I will go ahead and introduce the next speaker, which is me. I am Mike Michaud. I am a research scientist at the University of Albany. And my presentation is Preparing the Future of TV Warnings and Alerts Using Eye Tracking to Measure How Warning Information Design Can Impact Understanding and Retention. So I'll be talking a little bit about the potential for using next generation TV. And if you're not familiar with next generation TV, if I can get to the next slide, there we go. Next generation TV, or also known as ATSC 3.0, from a more technical standpoint, is a new way of broadcasting TV over the air waves. So this is not cable, this is over the air. And it is rolling out across the nation currently. There's a lot of new capabilities. Some of the biggest ones that are important for alerting are customizable information. So receivers can customize what types of information they receive. There is geo-targeting capabilities. So you can receive different types of information depending on where you live and where your receiver is located. And then there's also the opportunity to break into different type of networking. So you could break into live TV. You can also potentially turn on a TV that is equipped to share some type of alert. So obviously there's a lot of cool opportunities here. Because of that, there has been a group of broadcast professionals, emergency managers, broadcast meteorologists that have come together to form a group called AWARN, which is the Advanced Warning and Response Network, to really advocate for the potential for all of this. A couple of years ago, they started putting together some different templates of designs of what how we could display different types of alerts, and that has led to our research today. So we do have a large interdisciplinary cross-sector team who's coming together looking at this, and this is a list here of all of the different people that have been working on this project. Together, we designed three different stages of research. The first was a content analysis of looking how is information currently displayed on different TVs. So that was completed last year, and I presented the findings from that at the AMS annual meeting back in January. We also did eye tracking experiments to see where people were looking within the design. And then another group focus groups focusing in on what type of information do people actually want to see. So for the rest of the talk, I'll be focusing on the eye tracking experiments that we did. As you know, when we have warning information, we want to make sure that people can capture as much and absorb as much information as they can about the warning and is fast as time possible. So to do that, we wanted to see where are people actually focusing when they see different types of warning screens. So the methods that we used for this entire process was eye tracking. So this is a real-time measure of attention. By looking at where people are focusing their attention, we can measure what they're actually paying attention to. It's a covert measure. It's not something that people have to tell us where they're looking. We can actually go in and we can observe exactly where people are looking on the screen, which I'll show in just a minute. And it's also sensitive to individual differences. So if we know different things about individuals, we can go and see where different demographics of people are maybe looking at different times. We also had interviews, so we had semi-structured interviews with each participant after doing eye tracking to get a little bit more information about what were their perceptions of the design, what they liked, what they didn't like, what more information did they want, and then followed up with a survey. So how did they feel about the design? So we asked some feeling questions, asked about their hazard experiences and their demographics. So the process was the participant came in, we calibrated the eye tracker, they sat at this chair right here, put their head in a headrest, which is kind of like going to the eye doctor, just helps, keeps your head still, and then looks at different stimuli on the screen. So we calibrated their eyes, they viewed three different designs, which I'll show you in just a minute. Whole process took about less than 10 minutes, it went pretty quick. Then we had an interview, it took about another 10 minutes, and then they completed the survey. So the whole process took about 30 to 40 minutes. We had a total of 33 participants, which are all undergraduate students at the university, and they participated for credit in a psychology class. So these are the three stimuli that we showed them, and these are all based off of the content analysis that we completed. So the top left design is the most simple design. You can see at the bottom there's a crawl with different text about the warning, and then there's a county warning map showing the polygon or in some cases the counties that were under the warning. This was most representative of what we saw across the local TV stations when they had some type of warning information. The top right design was something that was a little bit more representative of the weather networks, so Weather Channel, Fox Weather, AccuWeather, Weather Nation. With the L-bar design, they generally had more information, more graphics, more room to show weather information. And then on the bottom is it kind of a combination of both of those. So it's a combination of both of those different designs, replicating some information to see what would be look like if there was a lot of information there. You'll notice that there's three different hazards that we use. So each participant saw each one of these images for a different hazard to minimize learning between them. So we had a hurricane warning, a tornado warning, and then a snow squall warning. And we also told participants that to imagine that they were watching a nature show and that the warning was separate from what they're seeing in the background. We used just common images to prevent any copyright issues, but it was just kind of a common background that you can see. I'll also note that in most cases, the information here would be changing or crawling. Text would be crawling across the screen. Just to make things a little bit simpler for eye tracking experiment, we used just a static image that you can see here. So this is an example of what the eye tracking actually looks like. And I'm going to start the loop here. And you can see the screen. You can see that there's a little pink purplish dot that's kind of jumping around the screen. That's actually where participants are. This participant is focusing their attention. So you can see they kind of started. They started in the middle, which is where we had everyone start. But then they instantly went down to look at the text information. And they kind of moved their eyes around the screen. I'll play it one more time for you. So you can see that they started in the middle, and then they kind of went down looking at the counties, then they were looking at the snow squall warning, looked down at the read the text at the bottom, and then they went over to the left-hand side and started looking at some of the graphics there. So this whole time here was 17 seconds, which is kind of about the average for how long people were looking at these images before they decided to advance to the next one. So it's a very quick time that people were looking at these screens. And now looking at some of the preliminary results, we did finish the eye tracking in May, so we're still working through all of this data. So this is some of the preliminary results sharing with you today. Looking at the simplest design, this is a heat map of looking across all of the different participants who looked at this particular stimuli, which is snow squall warning. You can see that people paid a lot of attention to the background image, kind of where the path disappeared behind the trees. A lot of people were focused right there in the center, which there's some theories in photography that says it's the disappearing point, so there's definitely some elements of that. But 42% of the time that people were looking at this image, they're looking at that background image. 27% of the time they're looking at the crawl, which you can see there's some specific things within the crawl that they're looking at. Snow squall warning is something that they're looking at a lot. And then also the timing of when it ends is something that they're looking at. And then 9% of the time they were looking at the county warning map. And we can see a big difference between the simplest design and the most complex design of where people's focus changes. So background is still the most commonly with 19% of the time spent there, but there's a lot of different elements here that people spent time at. So again, we can see that text was a higher element that people were looking at. People were looking at the top crawl and the bottom crawl about 14% of the time. And you can see, again, they're kind of focusing on the snow squall warning and the timing were kind of the two hot spots within that area. Less amount of time looking at the graphics, so less time looking at the radar and at the different warning maps. And then some time spent looking at the logo as well. This was also echoed within our interviews. So the big thing that we took away from the interviews is that participants thought irrelevant images were distracting. You can see that the background here isn't representative of a tornado, but participants wanted to see some type of environmental cue of what was going on. They wanted to see an on-air meteorologist talking about what was going on. They wanted to see damage or pictures of a tornado. One participant noted that this design was too boring because it wouldn't catch their attention just with the information. They wanted to have more information and to actually see. They also wanted more information. As if you were in Kenzie's talk yesterday, location was a big thing there. That was also echoed here as well. They wanted more information about specific locations about where they were, more information about timing, specifically when the hazard was starting. There was an end time for the warning, but there was no information about starting, and then overall severity. So if it was a snow squall, they wanted to know how fast the winds are, what type of or how much snow they're going to get, how fast the winds were for a tornado and for hurricane as well. And then also redundant objects were too complicated. In this complex design, there were two crawls that were the same, and then there were two county warning maps that were the same as well. And most participants wanted one of those to be taken away of both. A bunch of people did want to have the county warning maps taken away totally because they didn't feel like it was helpful to them. They actually preferred having the radar and more emphasis on the radar. And then overall, people did prefer the L-bar design that did include more information. So on the chart on the right, you can see that the L-bar was preferred over the other types of designs. And to wrap up with some final thoughts, warning design is important. We can see here that there's a big difference in how people perceive and attend to different types of designs just within these three different designs. Generally, people were spending more time focusing on the information in the complex displays. As I said, the earlier participant thought that having just the crawl and the warning box was too boring. They wouldn't focus on it. They wanted to have something more to call their attention to if it was something that they had to pay attention to. Participants also wanted more information, but not redundant information. They wanted to see some type of environmental cues, which we see in the warning literature is something that is common. People want to identify and personalize what's happening for them. But they don't want redundant information. If there's too much redundant information, they're going to tune out of possibly some of the important areas. And we also need more research. This is just a first step. There's so much more that we can do with this. We are going to start looking at individual differences to see if there's maybe a difference between males and females and where they attract attention to, other demographics that we collected. There could be a lot more done with looking at dynamic displays, so actually have text crawling and having video in the background. There's a lot that can be done, but there's only limited funding. So hopefully we'll find some additional funding for this so that we can continue this research and make better displays for the future. And with that, I will wrap up. I also want to say a big thank you to Baron Weather, Steve Bray at Baron Weather, who helped design all of the stimuli for us. So it was a huge help. So big thank you to him as well.
Great presentation, Chair Michael. Does anyone have any questions at all?
So to first clarify, you said that during the experiment, did people look at static images or they were seeing TV?
They're looking at static images. Yep.
So that's not the real scenario, right? Like people are watching their favorite TV show.
Right, exactly.
We always hear complaints that we interrupted their favorite live show when not just the L shape we cover, right? The TV meteorologists go on. So I think that will be also interesting to see if there's enough information to avoid the interruption, because then again, people will be switching the channel and they will be not getting any information.
Right.
And then also for the map, I saw, yes, there were, you know, the polygons or the counties, but I didn't see any wording on it. So if people don't know how their county looks like, then that kind of becomes irrelevant. So I'm thinking if maybe like a listing or maybe adding also icons to like tornado warning and then add an icon to it. Mm-hmm. So that way people can maybe it will catch their attention more than just text.
Yeah, we were designing this based off of what we saw in our content analysis. So what we designed was to be as ecologically valid as possible. We tried to simulate exactly what we are seeing is currently out there. We did not include any names on the county warning maps because most of the county warning maps that we saw on actual stations did not have names. There are also no icons. So all of those things through the focus groups that that part of the team was also collecting, they're collecting data on what people wanted to see and how helpful that could be. For this stage, we were just looking at what's currently there so that way we can see those differences. And then we can start adding different elements. We can maybe try putting the crawl at the top. There are some people that wanted it at the top. There's research that says information at the top will be have more attention than if it's at the bottom. So all of those different elements we'll be able to play with and test for in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, my question is also about the background images. So if that's meant to represent like TV programming,
right?
How come you didn't use the exact same background image for all test cases? Because isn't that like a confounding variable? Like people's attention might be more drawn to the background depending on what the background is rather than the crawl itself.
It could be, but since they're looking at there are different. Everyone saw the simplest image, then the more moderate, and then the more complex design. And the reason why we did that in part was so that way the first image they saw, they would get used to the background, but then they'd already know it in the other ones. We didn't want that to be on the opposite scale where we wanted people not to have like it learning within the experiment as much as possible.
I'll also throw in, we were the focus group counterparts, and we did use the same static image. And it still didn't really seem to matter.
I think that is all time, unfortunately. But I will be around if anyone has more questions after this. And we'll move on to the next presentation. So our next presentation is also joining us virtually.
Okay, hi everyone. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can. Do you want to put it in presentation? Okay, it's working on presentation. So, and I will just introduce, this is Sharon from the University of Miami presenting on bringing the value chain for high impact weather warnings into the classroom.
Okay, thank you, Michael. So is this visible to everyone, the title slide?
Yes, it is.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to present this work. Apologies for not being there in person. Following Michael, his talk, that this talk also demonstrates the value of involving students in the weather warning enterprise. And I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators, David Hoffman, Beth Ebert, and Brian Golding, who've really been the forefathers of the concept of a value chain. So we'll introduce that now. So we can think about the whole timeline through before and during and a bit after a weather event. And one can think upstream here where we have weather observations. These observations are simulated into the weather forecast models. Observations also used for nowcasting. These then evolve into hazard forecasts and forecasts of the impacts of the event. And then these, of course, have to be communicated. And through the warning communication, then decisions are made by officials and the public. So the value chain concept comes from economics, but we see that it can be very clearly applied to weather warnings, where we have these mountains here, and then we have these bridges that are supposed to connect these mountains, but they need evaluation for every event. And so our purpose here is this part. It's reviewing the value chain for specific weather events after the event has ended. So this all stems from the World Meteorological Organization Value Chain Project. It's a collaboration between two particular projects that are under the WMO umbrella. And we're a 40-plus member project team that comprises people from all different sectors and many different disciplines. Here's a QR code, so you can go to the website for the Value Chain Project. And it's also especially important for finding the template questionnaire, which is really the crux of this talk. So the group leadership developed this questionnaire of about 40 questions. And there are about 8 questions or so on each of those 6 particular themes on the previous slide. There are some examples of questions just listed here. One of them, for example, is how reliable and accurate were the weather forecasts at different lead times? Then another one that's further downstream in the chain is of those exposed, who and what were vulnerable to the hazards and why? And then to what extent were warning messages received and understood by the public? So as you can see, these questions are very broad, and there are 40 of them, so one could really compile a lot of information. And of course, even within these questions, there's a whole spectrum of answers. So globally, there are about 18 high-impact weather case studies that are available here. Some of them address particular pieces of the value chain, and some of them represent the or encompass the entire flow of the value chain. So I teach an undergraduate level tropical weather and forecasting course. So the students are mostly sophomores. And to take a little break from the standard observations and forecasting that we do, that we thought that would unleash the value chain evaluation template on the students. And so we've done this for 3 years in a row for 3 landfalling hurricanes, all beginning with I. We divided the class into teams of about 3 students each, and we unleashed the students on essentially to find themselves online resources, especially local and national media, and then also archived images from NOAA, the U.S. Geological Survey, and others to try and construct answers to these questions with the knowledge that answers would likely be quite incomplete. The students had specific interest in this section of the value chain, that the course largely covers a lot about forecasting and observations, but they really expressed interest in the hazards, the impacts, the warnings, and the decisions. So I gave each student a specific series of questions that they addressed individually. And then in each of these 4 themes, the groups of students then collaborated and created a presentation on each theme and then presented that to their classmates. I compiled the written responses into a long report. It was about 70 pages, and then gave it to the value chain group leadership, who then further edited the report. And now that report is available on the database so that anyone can access it. So it then gives some lessons learned from the different cases that people from around the world can access. So I'll just go through a couple of the cases that the students studied here. First is Hurricane Ida. Ida formed just 3 days before it made landfall as a Category 4 hurricane in New Orleans. And then Ida also unfortunately caused a lot of serious damage downstream. The remnants of Ida caused some fairly severe flooding in the New York area, and unfortunately many fatalities. The students compiled a lot of graphics. Here's just a little snapshot of a few of them. That this is what they based a lot of their discussions on. For example, with the hazards, there were the forecast wind threats and the flooding flash flooding outlooks. For impact forecasting, there were storm surge potentials that were presented on TV channels. For the weather warning, that for example, we see here that there's wind and flooding warnings, and based on these, that decisions, of course, had to be made. The students had a lot of findings from each of these hurricanes, and here are just a few highlights or lowlights. So, for example, with the hazards, that the students smartly pointed out that in the northeastern U.S., there was already quite a lot of rain from a few previous weather systems, including Hurricane Henri. And so the stream flow measurements were already high, and the northeastern U.S. was ripe for surface flooding. Students also point out that there's a new FEMA impact forecasting tool, and they raise the question that how much was this tool used by officials. On the impact side, well, there's a whole range of impacts in the southern states and then in the New York area. And unfortunately, in the New York area, there are many flooded basements, and it turned out that this was a lot of illegal housing. For warning communication, there are a couple of pretty key take-homes here. One was the rapid change between the messaging of a lot of uncertainty while Ida was in the Gulf of Mexico to prepare now, just as it was approaching the New Orleans area for landfall. And then there was also a fairly substantial difference between the way that people responded to the words Cat 4, Hurricane Ida, which raised a lot of alarm, versus the softer sounding remnants of Ida, which was propagated more so in the Northeast. The response efforts that the students found were quite compounded by the pandemic at the time and also intense heat down south. The students pointed out that generally New Orleans was very well prepared, partly perhaps due to memories of Katrina 16 years prior. But in New York, there were quite a lot of gaps in the preparation. Students identified quite a few articles that pointed out warning fatigue or even complacency amongst the public that there may have been overwarning. Just a brief summary of a couple of the more recent storms. So Hurricane Ian was a very devastating storm. It brought, unfortunately, 149 deaths in Florida alone. Some of the challenges that the students found were that the impact forecast, it's largely the storm surge here, was dependent largely on the track forecast, in which there was uncertainty as there normally is. And furthermore, there were misinterpretations of the cone of uncertainty by officials and the public. And this may have led to inconsistencies in the evacuation protocols, where there were perhaps some more cautious approaches, which turned out to be the correct approaches, versus some more high-risk approaches referred to as just in time. Hurricane Idalia was a more encouraging case in 2023, that it made landfall just to the north in a relatively sparsely populated area of northwestern Florida. There was higher forecast confidence for this case, which then led to more consistent messaging, and it helped facilitate preparation and decisions. And perhaps the recency of Ian also helped with this level of preparation. Of course, hitting a more sparsely populated area caused a lot less damage. That there were impacts on the timber industry, and here's just a picture as an example of that. But by and large, Idalia provoked a lot more positive responses to the questions on the template. Across all the events, the three independent classes of students found a few common threads. So one was that there were multiple methods of public communication. The use of social media was not surprisingly widespread. The students did point out a lot of accessibility issues. In a preparation recovery, that it was reported a lot that there were demographic factors in each of those three landfalling hurricanes. On the positive side, the students pointed out that there was very strong interagency communications. That's quite encouraging. And also, they identified organizational responses, such as plans in the Florida state law that could be followed. And then also, there are various public online resources that are available to officials and the public, such as preparedness programs. The students raised a question about how widely these are being implemented. The Australian Bureau of Meteorology, they took a different approach. There were 10 supervised projects, and they compare the value chain, one for these Australian events, and then for an overseas event here. Some things that they found here was that for the Australian fires, that there was limited public knowledge of how to defend the public, how to defend themselves in a community. Was with the floods and with the public's experience with floods that there were flood action plans in place, although some of the service outages through the flooding then restricted the warning communication. Interestingly, there was a flash case study of an active hurricane that the Australian Bureau of Meteorology implemented. So that was just one afternoon session with everybody doing a very quick evaluation. Okay, three slides of conclusions here. First on the students' feedback, and it was generally enthusiastically received, and the students enjoyed the responsibility of serving as an evaluator. They mentioned that it enhanced their research and composition skills, and that it built a comprehensive view of the weather events beyond just the forecasting. And so they learned about the information flows and also how to reflect on how to improve various elements of the value chain. Students found it quite a refreshing change from the traditional classroom environment, including their exposure to disciplines that are not traditionally in meteorology curricula. Our lessons learned that we found that the approach generally worked to the first order. I think largely this is due to the strength of the template questionnaire that the working group leadership developed. There are direct contributions to the global community that the students really enjoyed, and also helped us capture graphics and articles that can quickly disappear from online resources. There is a lot of scope for further in-depth assessment. We just did some fairly quick studies here, and we recognize the information can be fairly incomplete and potentially even inaccurate, and much of it is based on anecdotes. Formal evaluations would take a lot more time, especially for quantification of forecast skill and impacts. We would really like to encourage educators to incorporate the value chain in meteorology curricula. It's fairly low maintenance. There's quite a lot of flexibility in how one sets up the exercises, that they could be just very quick studies right through to full-on master's or PhD projects, or as part of a particular sort of collaborative research project. One can focus on specific elements of the value chain, and also it can be extendable to all types of hazardous events, not even just weather events, but also earthquakes and other types of events too. And we strongly encourage the engagement with the operational centers and stakeholders. So I'll stop there. Feel free to contact me at any time. And also, here are the references, and this last article has just been accepted in BAMS with minor revisions, and we encourage you to look at that and to contact us with any questions. So I'll stop there and be happy to address any questions if there's time.
Thank you so much for that. I think we have time for one quick question. If anyone has a question, I will run the mic out to you. No questions. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for that talk. That was awesome. We're going to move on to our last speaker for the day. I'm sorry, the session. Not end of the day yet. So our last talk for the session is Kristen Kretschel from Spectrum News, Wisconsin, also just finished a master's in emergency management at Millersville University, and she'll be sharing emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists.
Thank you. So excited to be here today. My name is Kristen Kretschel. I am the midday meteorologist for Spectrum News One in Wisconsin. We cover the entire state of Wisconsin, a really unique setup that we have there. And I just completed my master's degree in emergency management from Millersville University about a month ago. So this is all brand new and super exciting. Thank you. Thank you so much. So for the capstone course in the program, we had the opportunity to decide on a research project. It is not advancing for me right now. For the capstone course at Millersville University, we had the option to either choose, thank you, to do a research project, an internship, or if you were already in an emergency management position, to do something new in your field. I work full-time. I'm also a mom to two kids, and I started thinking back on my own career and the interactions that I had had with the emergency managers that, I had experienced in the different markets that I've worked in. I've been in the field of broadcast meteorology for 15 years. I've worked in four different states on different coasts, And I realized that with the exception of a few times, I had very positive interactions with the emergency managers that I had worked with, but those interactions were very few and far between. So I wanted to kind of do a little bit of research and see if that was not just the case with me, if that was very common in the field as a whole. So I started off with a 20-question survey that I created and I posted to two broadcast meteorology Facebook groups. I begged for people to respond. And after about 3 weeks, I received a total of 115 survey responses. 108 of those are current broadcast meteorologists, and 7 of those were former broadcast meteorologists, but at least had some experience in the field. Out of all the respondents, they represented 40 of the 50 states, so I felt like I had a really good sampling size of the number of different people working in different states, different size markets, smaller TV markets, larger TV markets. There was a really good spread. The overall goals of the research were to establish an understanding of the current relationship between broadcast meteorologists and emergency managers, not only in my state of Wisconsin, but across the country, and then identify any ways in which that relationship could actually be improved. So the survey questions varied. There were 20 of them. A lot of those were, you know, select all that apply. There were a few answers you could choose from. And some of them had an option to actually write in any your own personal experiences or any examples of your interactions with emergency managers. So we talked about the current relationship that people were experiencing, how they feel about the relationship and the partnership between emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists as a whole. If there's any difference between those relationships at the local county level compared to the state level, some of the benefits that we could see from a stronger relationship between these two fields that seem to be operating almost parallel to each other with very little interaction as a whole, if there are any barriers that could prevent that stronger relationship from actually occurring, and if there's any ways that we could improve on this relationship as a whole. So the hardest part of this was getting 20 questions down into like 12 slides and picking the most important thing. The entire research paper is 28 pages long. If anyone wants to read it, I can send it to you after this. But the first question started off with basically, how familiar are you with the roles and responsibilities of emergency managers? And again, this is from the perspective of broadcast meteorologists. And you'll see the vast majority of people who responded to the survey said they were at least somewhat or even very familiar with those roles and responsibilities. So I wanted to establish a baseline if there was already some type of understanding before we got into kind of the nitty-gritty of how the relationship currently exists across these two fields. And then I wanted to compare how people describe their current relationship with their county emergency offices or offices of emergency management compared to their state offices. And what you'll notice here in the comparison is that most broadcast meteorologists claim that some type of relationship with both of those offices is virtually non-existent, which I do think is problematic, and I do think that there is an opportunity there for more collaboration and more of a discussion to try and make sure that we're developing and cultivating these relationships for the betterment of the communities that we serve. The number was a lot higher for the state offices of emergency management, which actually was not surprising when I thought about my own career, because when we're dealing with severe weather situations or any type of critical weather events, we're primarily dealing with things at a more localized level, at a city level, at a county level. So, however, I did think that there was opportunity for collaboration with state offices when we're in those quiet times, the preparedness aspects, you know, after when we're doing, you know, recovery and talking about mitigation and resiliency, those types of things after we see any type of critical weather situation. And then in general, is there a strong partnership? Do people believe there's a strong partnership between broadcast meteorologists and emergency managers at the local and state levels? And again, the vast majority of the respondents claimed that no, they did not think that there was a strong partnership, whether it was at the local level or at the state level. So very small percentage believe that yes, there was a strong partnership. So staggering number though, 75% were in the no column for that relationship or partnership at the state level. However, on the flip side of that, 88% of respondents believe that there are ways to strengthen the relationship, especially when it comes to trying to ensure clear, concise, and consistent messaging. So the three C's, something that we really harp on as broadcast meteorologists. We want to be clear, we want to be concise, we want to make sure that our messaging is consistent. So 88% of those survey respondents believe that yes, we know the relationship is struggling, but we do believe that there are ways to fix it. So what are some of the benefits that could come from that? And this was a select all that apply. There were several answers that people could choose from. And 85% of the respondents believe that better coordination and dissemination of critical information was probably the most important key benefit of developing and cultivating this relationship between the two fields. Enhanced public safety during severe weather events also came in at about 80%. And then increased trust and confidence among the public was fairly high as well. We're having a trust issue. People are in the, I gotta see it before I believe it, before I take action. And so maybe developing this partnership between the two fields can actually create more instances where people are quicker to react and take action if they do feel like they can trust us instead of just seeing it for themselves before they take the necessary action during any type of severe critical weather events. But a lot of people did note that there are barriers that could potentially hinder the establishment of a strong professional relationship between emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists. 68% claimed limited availability for coordination during critical weather events, and I think that's the same on both sides. From a broadcast meteorologist's perspective, if we're in tornado coverage, we're wall to wall. We have very little time to pick up the phone and make a phone call ourselves to emergency managers and see what they're seeing. NWS chat, Slack issues aside, has been a phenomenal resource for emergency managers to just quickly type in what they're seeing. But we have limited availability for direct coordination and communication when we're in the middle of a big weather event. Insufficient understanding of each other's roles and responsibilities came in at 57%, which I also found very interesting because if you remember back to the first slide, most of us claim that we have at least some type of understanding of what emergency managers do for a living. But here we're saying, yeah, you know what, maybe we don't have an understanding of what each other's roles and responsibilities are in this case. And then 51% of respondents noted a difference in priorities and objectives. You know, we do work in two different fields. Our priorities and objectives are different on a daily basis. However, as a whole, our goals are the same. And then if there's any strategies or initiatives that respondents believe could strengthen the professional relationship between emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists. And the number one thing was joint training sessions and workshops. A lot of us have gone to those IWT meetings, and they've been fantastic. You know, meeting with emergency managers, meeting with our National Weather Service offices, having that chance for collaboration, but there's very little follow-through after that. And it takes work, it takes dedication to maintain a relationship between the two fields. It's not just, you know, unless you're my four-year-old son in preschool, you're not going to meet someone for the first time and decide you're best friends for life, right? So it takes work, right? It takes work on both sides. Both sides have to be willing to first cultivate and then maintain these relationships over time. Also, greater involvement of both parties in pre-disaster planning and exercises. I actually put this response in there for me because going through the program, we're writing emergency operations plans, we're writing full-scale exercises and things like that. And I always thought it would be fantastic to participate in a full-scale exercise. So I was thinking to myself, I was like, you know, if my local emergency manager at any county that I cover in Wisconsin, if they called and they're like, hey, we're doing this full-scale exercise, you want to be a part of it? Not only would I want to be a part of it, I'd bring a news crew with me, we'd film it, we'd put it on TV, we'd talk about all the amazing things that County Office of Emergency Management is doing for the county to keep the county safe, how they're planning for all these things in the future. And it seems like a lot of other people in broadcast meteorology shared that same sentiment, which was actually really cool to see. And then regular meetings or forums to discuss emerging weather challenges. We know the climate's changing. We know that some of our storms are getting stronger. We have new challenges that are emerging every single day when it comes to covering weather from a broadcast standpoint, too. The push toward digital media, social media, as opposed to your standard broadcasting on TV. You know, there are a lot of challenges that we're facing as a whole, as a community, not just in the field of broadcast meteorology. So regular meetings or forums and discussions could be a way for us to try to talk about those weather challenges that we're currently facing and then come up with a plan together about how we can potentially overcome some of these challenges. And I also left an option for people to write in their own comments. And I selected these four specifically because these were not the only comments that were kind of – more than one person basically said the same thing here. So a respondent from Iowa said they would love to have a working professional relationship, but there's a lack of effort on their end and time is limited on ours to facilitate one. So how can we fix this? How can we – you know, start the process. Someone has to make the first move. Is it going to be someone on the broadcast side? Is it going to be someone on the emergency management side? Someone has to make the first move to get this thing going. We have to start somewhere. responded from Kentucky, so we communicate mainly during active or severe weather events, but even then there isn't a lot of direct collaboration and communication, which does kind of lead into the next comment as well about NWS chat making communication easier overall, but it does limit that direct communication. So there's very little opportunity outside of NWS chat, at least as of right now, for us to communicate directly with the emergency managers in our markets and in our states and cities, unless, you know, we start facilitating that relationship before we get into these big critical weather and disaster events. And the last comment, this was not the only person who said something like this too, which was actually pretty shocking to me. I think some of it comes down to the emergency manager, but also as broadcasters, we need to know who the emergency manager in each county is. Very true. A lot of us move around to different states. We're not in markets very long, but it is important that we know who's in charge in each of the counties, especially the larger counties that we are dealing with on a daily basis. Knowing who they are, at least having their contact information, is just hugely beneficial. And that was a respondent from Virginia who said that, but they also commented that they believe that emergency managers look down the field of broadcast meteorology, or they don't know how to use broadcasters effectively. I did mention that, you know, times are changing, right, where there's a push to social media. There's a lot of digital meteorologists that are out there too. But for broadcasters, we do still have a presence on several different mediums. So our ultimate goal is to reach as many people in the community as we possibly can before, during, and after we're dealing with critical weather events. So there are still ways to use us effectively throughout this entire process, whether we're talking about preparedness or whether we're talking about resilience or recovery. There are ways that we could be used effectively to get that messaging across for emergency managers. So some of the conclusions from my research that I found is that improving the relationship between broadcast meteorologists and emergency managers, it will require a collaborative and proactive approach that prioritizes communication, coordination, and a mutual understanding. It's no easy feat. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take work to develop and maintain these relationships over time. But the potential outcomes could lead to a community that's better informed and prepared, which will ultimately enhance community safety and resilience, which, again, is the ultimate goal across the entire weather community. And then providing those opportunities for education and training for both parties can improve the understanding of each other's roles, also foster mutual respect. I have a lot of respect for what emergency managers do after going through 2 years of graduate courses. And then this could lead to better collaboration during disasters. And so I think all of those things are very important and just the first step in this process of developing and maintaining this relationship, which could have some very, very beneficial impacts across not only our community, but really across the entire country. So with that, I've got a little over a minute here. I'm happy to take any questions you may have. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much for that. That was a great talk. I'm going to kick it off with the first question.
Okay.
And then Kyle will run the microphone around. This is great work. Are you planning on sharing any of this work with emergency managers?
So it's a really good question. When I submitted my my final paper to the professor for the course, he actually recommended I present this at IAEM. So it's something that I'm considering because I think it would be beneficial for emergency managers, since it's a conference, you know, mostly for them, to hear it directly from a broadcaster. Kind of what our field thinks and how things are going and the benefits that we see of developing and maintaining this relationship for the future. So we'll see what happens. Tough to get the station to pay for more than one conference, so we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Thank you. Hi, Holly Obermeyer. I work for NSSL and OU Zero. This is really great to see because this is such an underexplored link, but I'm curious, because we know from our researchers, or at least a lot of our research, that emergency managers are watching broadcasters very actively during ongoing disasters. So did you have time or did you ask what kind of information that broadcasters would want to receive from an EM in those situations? Like what would be important to them to know?
So not part of the direct research, but just from asking around to people, you know, I was actually talking to someone this morning in the elevator on the way here, and they were like, hey, I got a call from an emergency manager a few minutes before they were going to sound the sirens in one county. And I said that on the air, so they got additional warning before the sirens went off. So that type of thing, obviously, emergency managers and law enforcement do post in NWS chat if they're seeing, you know, like a funnel cloud, right, or if a funnel touches down and becomes a tornado, you know, yeah, what they're seeing. They're the eyes on the ground when we're in the studio.
Right.
So that type of information is hugely beneficial when we're covering a severe,
right,
weather event,
yeah,
plus any preparedness initiatives, any of those community outreach programs. I would love to hear about them too, and I'm sure many other people would too, just to try to get people more prepared and involved in weather safety and all of those things going forward.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the great presentation and congratulations.
Thank you.
I think putting my weather service hat on, I am a social scientist supporting the national centers, but I do a lot of work too with the local offices, and something that is interesting about this is in some places that relationship between broadcasters and emergency managers is mediated by the Weather Service,
mm-hmm,
through IWTs.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious to know if you had heard anything about the integrated warning team, if that had come up in any of the comments, if you'd looked at your responses based on maybe where there are more or less active IWTs. Because I can't help but wonder if there are places where these relationships are more functional in part because of that. For years, I've taken part in the Central Oklahoma one,
mm-hmm,
and I know that because of the things they talk about in and at those meetings, I hear on air they'll mention things about, I know this emergency manager is doing X, Y, Z thing, and you're right, those relationships take time to nurture.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are some other nurturers that can be tapped.
Yeah, so several people did actually comment about attending the IWT meetings and the benefits that came out of it. I think the problem that arose after that is that like they have all these wonderful things to say about that initial collaboration, but then it's the follow-through that just doesn't happen. So we have these fantastic meetings where the Weather Service does bring all of us together from all the different, you know, fields, broadcasting, emergency management, law enforcement, things like that. But once we have that initial meeting, you know, I think that we're lacking communication beyond that initial meeting, unless it's facilitated by the National Weather Service. So they're kind of acting as like a third party to kind of organize everything for us, when we really should be concentrating too on cultivating that relationship ourselves between emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists without that third party involvement, although it has been fantastic.
Great talk. Corey Armstrong from the University of Nebraska. My question is merely just thinking about A, the level of proactivity of the broadcast meteorologists when you're preparing for an event, and emergency managers are in their own way with their, you know, establishing their plans and their plans of action. But then they become very reactive to whatever the conditions are on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I almost feel like the motivations kind of diverge in that, you know, you guys are, okay, here we are, here's the event. And then we have the emergency managers who are rolling with managing,
mm-hmm,
all the different kinds of outcomes that are coming on. So I guess my question is it potentially the goals are a little bit different in that instance, which makes some challenges. And then my second question is, at that point, other reporters become involved. You know, the,
yes,
reporters of the disaster outcomes and again calamities and stuff like that. So I almost wonder if that, to improve the relationship, it has to be almost be a three-way prong because of the other reporters that would be dealing with reporting on all the other,
mm-hmm,
elements to it. So I'm just kind of thinking through that.
Yeah,
idea.
So to answer your first question, when we're in the middle of a weather event, our priorities and objectives are definitely going to diverge. You know, we're on TV, and like I said, there's very little opportunity for us to directly, you know, talk to emergency managers if we're on TV broadcasting, you know, especially in a continuous event, warning after warning after warning. It makes it really, really difficult to actually reach out and get any information directly from emergency managers, and they're doing the same thing. They have their own set of priorities and objectives that may not be in line with exactly what we're doing. They're kind of doing their own thing. We're doing their own thing. I think the opportunity for collaboration exists more before and after an event. And to answer your second question, yes, there are reporters and such that will be sent out to cover the disaster aftermath and things like that. A lot of that, though, where they're sent and things like that, they're relying on us for that information, for the broadcast meteorologists, too, to be like, hey, you know, there was damage here. We're getting a damage report from here. So, you know, in news as a whole, kind of a lot of the newsrooms rely on the meteorologist who is at the station for direction of where to go and where to, you know, where they're going to find the damage video and to kind of follow up on any damage and things that have occurred. I'm going to be in the break if anybody has any other questions.
Yes, sir.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, everyone, for
attending. I'd also like to thank Kyle, our student assistant, for all of his awesome work throughout the session. We do now have a coffee break until 10:45, and then we'll have a panel, an awesome panel with some awesome representatives talking about the futures of warnings. So we'll see you all then.